This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
When your business gets hacked, not if, but when, don't expect Uncle Sam to save you, everybody. Cybersecurity on the broadcast today. They're marketing clean air over in China, and it's selling pretty well. Also, what not to order at a fancy business lunch. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Wednesday, the 13th of March. Good to have you with us, everybody. So imagine the White House has called, said to the president, wants you to come for a meeting. You get there this morning, they take you downstairs, maybe way downstairs, I don't know. People swipe their ID cards, maybe their biometric measuring devices, I don't know. But all of a sudden, some door whooshes open, and you're in the Situation Room, the real one. Not the one on CNN. It's you and a bunch of fellow defense and technology company CEOs there to talk cybersecurity. This has been a week heavy on digital threats in Washington. Intelligence, defense, and counterterrorism officials have been sounding the alarm in speeches and on Capitol Hill. Today, in fact, the White House welcomed Beijing's willingness to hold talks on cyber threats. But in the meanwhile, there was that meeting down in the Situation Room. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has more now on businesses at the front lines of national security.
One clear impact of the White House cybersecurity push is pressure on business to do more. Attorney Stuart Baker is a former senior official at the Homeland Security Department. He just met with Silicon Valley execs who are feeling the heat.
Their boards of directors are asking questions about their cybersecurity and whether they've had intrusions and how they've responded to them. And that's a direct result of the kinds of publicity we're seeing for these attacks.
America's top cyber commander said yesterday there have been 140 attacks on Wall Street firms in the past 6 months. Whether it's companies or governments, figuring out the right budget for digital defense is tricky. You never really know when you've spent too much. You only know if you've spent too little when you get hacked. Experts don't even agree on how much is being spent now.
$18 billion. Another number says it's $60 billion.
Jim Lewis is a cybersecurity expert at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He says for all they spend, companies aren't even doing the simple things right. Boring stuff like managing passwords and updating software.
This is not rocket science. That'll remove about 80% of the successful attacks.
So who should pay? Companies argue the government should take more of the burden. Tom Field is VP at Information Security Media Group, a trade publisher. He hears from a lot of frustrated execs.
There's a sense that you want the government to come in and secure the cyber borders the same way the physical borders are secured.
Of course, taxpayers may not be too thrilled to pay for the security of private companies. We may not know what the tab will be, but it won't be cheap. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
We've called Kim Zetter. She's a senior writer at Wired magazine for a little context here, because cybersecurity is one of those stories you can't really wrap up in just 90 seconds. So, hey, Kim, how are you?
I'm good, Kai.
So, listen, on the theory that a company will get hacked, right? I mean, that's going to happen. So a company, whether it's Coca-Cola or the Metropolitan District of Washington Water Supply, they get hacked and they want to go on the offensive. They want to go do something about it. Can they?
Yeah, no, they can't.
Okay, thanks for coming.
Well, just because there's a law against hackers, there's also a law against, you know, companies hacking back.
Okay, what can they do? I mean, it's a little bit like self-defense, though, isn't it?
Well, you can be self-defensive. You can, you know, protect yourself against an attack. You can't go back after the hacker, though, or after the computer that appears to be attacking you, because that's basically doing what the hacker is doing.
Well, then the logical response to that is, what am I supposed to do? Just sit here and take it?
No. I mean, you can take the defensive measures that you need to take. You can inform law enforcement. Hmm. You can also inform the ISPs or the hosting companies that seem to be hosting servers that are involved in malicious activity. And those things are all done right now. They're done by, you know, the security firms, the antivirus companies. They're done by law enforcement. But you as a private company can't go after the attacker.
What about the federal government then? Is it appropriate, would you say? Is it proper? Is it legal for the federal government to go on the offensive on behalf of, say, Coca-Cola or Microsoft or Lockheed Martin, a big defense contractor, if they have been hacked?
Well, it depends what you mean by offensive. And I think that this is a sort of a term that hasn't really been defined well. In terms of the government going on the offensive, they can take certain legal measures. Like I said, they can go after the servers. They can get servers taken down. They can't hack the servers, but they can go after the authorities that host the servers and get those taken down so that they can, for instance, eliminate a botnet's activities.
Remind us what a botnet is. It just does things automatically, right?
A botnet is basically an army of zombie computers that the hackers have taken over. Now, you know, your computer or mine, we get some malware right on it, and it becomes a zombie in their army. And they can use those computers to then attack other computers, to do a denial of service, to take down a website, or to distribute spam, or to distribute malware.
Is there room for a, and I apologize for this phrase, a public-private partnership in this cyber threat area? I mean, you know, could I, if I'm running Microsoft with $40 billion in cash, can I say to the federal government, listen, I'll pay for $2 billion worth of really good technical cyber stuff because we have no money in the federal government?
Well, interesting. I want to go back to the partnership. Let's take the money off the table for a second here. There are interesting partnerships that are happening right now. Microsoft, for example, has partnered with law enforcement to actually take down botnets. There's also a case recently of Facebook partnering with law enforcement to help take down botnets. So there is, you know, combined activity now. You know, a company, like I said, can't do this on their own, but they can take certain actions that help law enforcement. They can file civil lawsuits against perpetrators if they know who they are, or they can file civil lawsuits to get control of servers, things like that. So there are things that private companies can do, but like I said, they just can't hack back.
Kim Zetter, she's a senior writer at Wired Magazine. Kim, thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today, all the computers seem to be working another high on the Dow. And, oh, yeah, there's new Pope, too. We'll have the details about Wall Street, not the Pope, when we do the numbers. You know all those big online college classes, MOOCs is the technical name, Massive Open Online Courses. And by the way, if you've got a better name, send it along to us. Anyway, the deal is that most schools don't give academic credit for them, which seems kind of lame. And a lawmaker out here in California agrees. He introduced a bill today that would require public colleges and universities in this state to give credit for MOOCs when students can't get into those classes on campus. From the Education Desk at WYPR, Amy Scott reports.
Budget cuts have taken such a big bite out of California's community colleges and universities that thousands of students are turned away from the classes they need.
No college student should be denied the right to complete their education because they could not get a seat on the course that they needed in order to graduate.
That's Daryl Steinberg, president pro tem of the California State Senate. He introduced a bill today that would let those shut-out students take faculty-approved online courses for credit. That could be really good news for companies like Straighter Line here in Baltimore. It sells low-cost intro courses like the ones students are having trouble getting into.
What it also does is open a much larger marketplace.
Burke Smith is CEO of Straighter Line. He says competition is also good for students and taxpayers.
A larger marketplace will ultimately drive prices down, will, you know, raise quality up, and that's a good thing.
Others looking for a bigger slice of that market are providers of those massive open courses, companies like Udacity and Coursera. Classes on artificial intelligence and gamification have been wildly popular, but few colleges accept them for credit. King Alexander is president of Cal State Long Beach. He's concerned that too few students who sign up for MOOCs actually finish them. Of course, that might change when the stakes are higher.
At the moment, we're very neutral but very optimistic about taking advantage of these technologies.
Faculty also have good reason to be nervous, says Kevin Carey. He's director of education policy at the New America Foundation.
It may mean that people who right now are employed as adjunct professors teaching these basic classes will not have those jobs in the future.
The bill has to pass first. With Democrats controlling the legislature, it's got a good shot. Senator Steinberg said today, if it weren't a little bit controversial, it wouldn't be worth doing. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Big, big day in the smartphone biz tomorrow. Samsung's going to release the latest version of its Galaxy line, the S4 to be precise. There will be, naturally, all the hoopla we've come to expect from a high-profile tech industry product launch. Hoopla that we have Apple to thank for, which is kind of funny because word is that Apple might now have real competition in the smartphone space. Marketplace's Queen of Kim reports.
The smartphone wars are fought on a lot of fronts. It starts with creating a great product, and Samsung's Galaxy is getting real cred for being innovative. Andrew Lee is an iPhone user and a professor of journalism at the University of Southern California. He's considering making a switch to the Galaxy.
So even their Retina display that they're touting with Apple is going to look a little bit low res compared to what Samsung's announcing this week.
Along with a sharper screen, the word is that the new Galaxy will have eye-tracking technology. A camera on the phone tracks your eyes when you're reading, and when you get to the bottom of the page, it scrolls down automatically. Still, Samsung has a lot of catching up to do in the U.S. Apple's got about 40% of the smartphone market to Samsung's 20. Carolina Milanese is an analyst at Gartner. She says with so many smartphones out there, you need an identity.
Branding has become an absolute must in this market.
Milanese says Samsung has positioned Galaxy as a real alternative to the iPhone, something no other cell phone maker has been able to do. And it's been spending plenty on advertising to do it. Prashant Malviya is a marketing professor at Georgetown's business school. He says last year,
Apple's budget increased to $333 million. But in contrast, Samsung's budget skyrocketed to $401 million.
Samsung has launched a series of clever ads, gently poking fun of iPhone as a has-been. So the real question now is whether Samsung can deliver on the next big thing tomorrow. In San Francisco, I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
In Beijing this week, China wraps up its National People's Congress. The world's second biggest economy will formally approve its new leaders in just a couple of days. And you'd think, that being kind of a big deal, that city officials would have done something to clean up Beijing's notoriously polluted air for the occasion. Not so. Air quality this past week in China's capital has been stuck at the hazardous levels it's been at all year, which is to say lousy, verging on downright dangerous. In fact, the bad air streak has prompted one not-so-polluted Chinese province to start advertising tours with clean air as a key selling point. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz reports.
Paris has culture. Barbados, beaches. What's the big draw to southeastern China's Fujian province? Breathable air. A television ad from Fujian's tourism bureau shows off the province's lush green mountains, sandy beaches, crystal clear views abound. Take a deep breath, says the voiceover. You're in Fujian. Zheng Weirong is the deputy director of the Fujian Tourism Bureau.
We launched the clean air tourism campaign in January. When Beijing's pollution levels were very bad, we're promoting 20 tourism sites around the province where people can breathe clean air.
Boasting about clean air may seem to set the bar pretty low, but in a country where just 1% of half a billion urban residents breathe air judged safe by European Union standards, Fujian's strategy is paying off. A guide holding a neon pink flag in one hand and a megaphone in the other corrals a group of tourists along an island pathway overlooking the sea in the city of Xiamen. On this particular day, Xiamen's level of what's known as PM2.5, particulate matter in the air small enough to enter your bloodstream, hovers around 45. That's dirtier than the most polluted day on record in Los Angeles over a 24-hour period. But these folks are from Beijing, where on this day, the level is 10 times as bad. Tourist Yunya is thrilled.
The air is so fresh here. Whenever I go to work in Beijing, I have to wear a mask or else I'll start coughing uncontrollably. It's just been terrible lately.
Yuan is part of a 38% spike in tourists to Fujian this year, twice the national average. Like most people I talk to, she came here to escape the smog.
China's always followed the path of pollute first, clean up later. But if China doesn't start cleaning up its environment, I'm afraid of what's going to happen. An environment like this one in China has become rare.
Fujian hugs China's southeastern coast. Its position along the Taiwan Strait helps diffuse pollutants in the air. Deng Junjun, a researcher at the China Academy of Sciences Institute of Urban Environment, says Fujian's air is cleaner than other parts of China thanks to policy decisions, too.
For 35 years, Fujian's government has ensured that it's had the highest forestry coverage rate throughout China.
Still, Deng says an increase in car ownership means that Xiamen's air, despite its national fame of a clean air city, is getting slightly dirtier each year. There are no cars here on a quiet tree-lined alley on the island of Gulangyu in Xiamen, just birds. And two young lovers on their honeymoon, holding hands, going for a morning stroll. Ai Jintao and Zhang Nana came here from Beijing.
It's nice to be here. On our way here, we drove through Shandong. The smog was so thick, the police had to close the highway. You couldn't even see the car in front of you. There's no traffic at all here. It's a little fog in the morning, but it smells like the ocean.
Ai says he'll be sure to take a deep breath before he heads back home to smoggy Beijing. In Xiamen, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Coming up...
You don't want to get something that is going to be slipping out of your mouth like spaghetti.
Business lunches. What could possibly go wrong? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 5 points today, less than a 10%, closed at 14,455. The NASDAQ rose a 10%, 2 points, 3245. The S&P 500 also added a 10%, 2 points, finished at 1554. Strong retail sales pushed up some retail stocks. Coach bagged almost 2%. Today, Abercrombie & Fitch and Nike each scored 2.5%. Kohl's put on 3%. On the downside, Dole slipped 9% on lower-than-expected revenues. Alcoa also dropped 9% today. Spectrum Pharmaceuticals backed up a whopping 37% after estimated revenue fell well below analysts' expectations. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.03%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. On Capitol Hill, Congress's Joint Economic Committee discusses the federal debt. Krispy Kreme releases quarterly earnings. Do you think they get donuts at their meetings? And it's Pi Day. Not in celebration of the dessert, but the mathematical constant that is the ratio of a circle circumference to its diameter, approximately equal to 3.14. A toast to Pi. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. There is a pretty direct correlation between how much you make and how much you can pay in rent every month. Makes sense, right? The problem is that across the country, one of those is going up and the other one is going down. Only one guess as to which one is which. Yeah, forget buying. Low-wage workers are increasingly struggling just to make the rent. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson reports.
Celexia Rodriguez used to spend more than 60% of her income on rent. She makes about $10 an hour cleaning houses in Boston and picks up any side work she can.
Even if I had 5 part-time jobs at $10 an hour, it's hard to come up with $1,500 and still, you know, support your children and fill your gas tank.
For 3 years, she and her 2 kids doubled up, sharing a place with her sister and her 2 kids. Now she's moved to the suburbs, and her rent's subsidized by a local nonprofit. So it's a much more manageable 30% of her income. But paying half your wages in rent is the norm for lots of people, over a quarter of renter households in 2010. Megan Bolton is the research director at the National Low Income Housing Coalition, which released a new report looking at rents and wages this week.
And we know that that's sort of there's a risk of homelessness because you just have so little left over for other basic necessities and you are unable to save for emergencies.
Less money for food, healthcare, travel also means the economic impact can spread from the renter to the communities they live in, says Eric Balsky, managing director of the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University.
They're spending less on other things in the local economy. There's, you know, no question. From nothing comes nothing.
And if renters are forced out of pricey cities because they can't afford the rents at all, tack on social impacts, like a loss of diversity as well. In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
If you want to see how many hours a week a minimum wage worker would have to clock in just to keep rents around 30% of their income, go to our website to get a state-by-state breakdown. It's marketplace.org. Here in California, by the way, it's 129 hours, also known as basically impossible. The housing market in this country is coming back slowly, but hopefully surely it's coming back. But commentator Robert Reich says it's not going to be the same housing market we knew 5 or 6 years ago.
The Fed's bond and mortgage purchases have kept long-term interest rates low, but they haven't done what the Fed intended, which was to help would-be homebuyers get affordable mortgages. Instead, they fueled a new round of speculation by investors and real estate developers, and that's meant a new generation of Americans has become renters rather than owners. Yes, home sales and prices have been rising, which in turn has created lots of construction jobs and made some homeowners feel a bit wealthier. All good for the economy, at least for now. But the housing market hasn't turned around because banks are issuing lots of new mortgages. Lending standards are still tight, and banks are reluctant to make loans, especially to younger people who'd otherwise be fueling the market for new homes. Unemployment remains high among millennials, more than 8% even for recent college graduates. And their student debts keep mounting. As a result, the number of first-time home buyers is still shrinking, and young buyers now make up their smallest share of the housing market in more than a decade. The rise in home prices and construction is being fueled instead by big investors who have no intention of living in the homes they buy or build. They're getting a high return on investment by borrowing at rock-bottom rates and then turning the properties into rental units, which young individuals and families are moving into in record numbers. Last month, a Pew Research survey found that the share of millennials who own their homes has fallen from 40% to 34% since the start of the recession, with a similar decline in residential debt. Overall, the percent of Americans owning their homes continues to drop, while the percent renting is growing. The housing market may be bouncing back, but not home ownership. And that's a big change for a society once based on the ideal of owning your own place.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book is called Beyond Outrage, The Next Economy and America's Future. No word from the White House on whether lunch or maybe just some snacks were served down in the Situation Room for that cybersecurity meeting today. But the president did have dinner with a group of senators last week, and he has been making the social rounds, as you probably read. Business meals like that can be great, an opportunity for people to get to know each other, to talk shop in a social setting, to make a good impression, perhaps. But as anybody who has sat down for one of those meals knows, with the ordering and the eating and the stress and the nerves, how do you not mess them up? We sent Marketplace's Adrian Hill out today for a little business lunch lesson.
I meet up with Jules Hurst from Etiquette Consulting, Inc. at a French cafe.
And you're going to teach me how not to screw up my next business lunch?
I am going to teach you how to not screw up and to be perfect on your next business lunch.
All right, let's do this.
First hurdle, figuring out what to order.
You don't want to get something that is going to be slipping out of your mouth like spaghetti.
You don't want noodles dribbling down your chin. What about a portobello burger?
A burger may not be the most delicate thing to eat. You're opening up.
Apparently, doesn't cut it at business lunches. In general, you don't want the food to be a distraction to getting a job or getting your point across. You want to follow your host's lead with the price or pick something right in that middle range.
This is not your time to try that new expensive dish because you are with, you know, in between jobs or whatever the reason is and can't afford it on your own.
Over the course of the meal, I make more than a few mistakes.
Just a quick review on napkins. It's the folded side that goes towards you. So that, there you go. Perfect.
A quick review means I've screwed up my first thing.
No, just a reminder. And you may also want to go ahead and, there you go.
The silverware has been appropriately separated.
And once the food arrives?
Is there anything I really shouldn't do?
Right there, talking with your mouth full. We don't need to see what you're eating.
So I knew that one. I was just testing you. I knew that one.
But Hirst tells me it's worth the work. All the attention to getting it right, all the fussiness. The thing to keep in mind about business lunches?
It's not to eat. It's to eat and.
And that and, that's the really important part. I'm Adrienne Hill, sitting up perfectly straight for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, courtesy of the Associated Press, the AP got its hands on an application for benefits under the new health care law, Obamacare it's called. A draft application, we should say. It's 15 pages long, estimated to take anywhere from 30 to 45 minutes to fill out. It was characterized as a daunting process in some of the reporting we read today. So we went out today and did a decidedly unofficial poll, asked some people on the street whether they think it's worth it, 45 minutes in exchange for healthcare benefits. Here's what they said.
Absolutely. I mean, if it means not having healthcare versus getting it, I would think it's a reasonable amount.
I think for people it would be a pain because it's too much to read.
15 pages? Fill it out. If it means that we're going to take care of each other.
I mean, you take 45 minutes to sit down and watch a game. You take 45 minutes to go to church. You believe that, God going to cover me. But every God tell you don't be ignorant.
That was Maness Arukabate in Washington, D.C. Nancy Eaton from Santa Cruz, California. Janine Porter from Hollister, California. And Carlos Duggar out in Washington, D.C. And that is Marketplace from Los Angeles and American Public Media today. The Dow is up 5 points, less than a 10%. 7 days of gains in a row, the longest streak for the Dow in 16 years. Count them up. NASDAQ up a 10%, 2 points. The S&P 500 added a 10%, 2 points there as well. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lanch, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.